Welcome to the Project Love podcast. I'm Selena Barker.
And I'm Vicky Pavitt. In these podcasts, we explore what it takes to create a life, relationship, and career you love.
And not just one that looks good on the outside, but one that feels good on the inside.
Hello and welcome to another Project Love podcast episode. It's Selena here, the career and life design coach of the duo. And today on the podcast, I have one of my all-time favorite human beings, Nova Reed. If you haven't come across Nova Reed, then get ready. This woman is pure inspiration and power. She's an inspirational TED speaker, writer, diversity and anti-racism campaigner. Her book, The Good Ally, is coming out at the end of this year, and her anti-racism and white privilege course that I did about a year and a half ago is truly one of the most powerful and life-changing courses out there. It is for white people who want to unpack their inner racism and their white privilege and learn how to be a good ally, and I cannot recommend it more. If you want to find out more about Nova and her courses, head on over to novareed.com, and I'll leave that link in the show notes. So I had Nova on for the third time onto the podcast. If you enjoy this one, I really recommend you go back and listen to our other two podcasts. The first one that we did on racism and anti-racism work was done the first time we met one another about a year and a half ago. And it was such a powerful conversation. And that was really where our friendship began. And since then, Nova and I have become really good friends and spend a lot of time talking about racism, anti-racism work, and surprisingly having a lot of laughter and lols at the same time. I really wanted to get Nova back onto the podcast to talk about what 2020 was like for her as an anti-racism educator in the wake of George Floyd, Black Lives Matter. It was a huge year for her. And well, I'll let her tell you all about it. But we talk about racism and anti-racism, as we always do. We talk about her work. We talk about what brings her joy. We talk about 2021 and what lies ahead. And yeah, as ever, we dive deep into conversation. So I hope you enjoy this. Nova, how are you? Welcome back on the podcast. The only guest that has now officially been invited on here three times.
Lucky me. Good to see you, Selena.
Good to see you too. I wish it was in person, but that day will come. That day will come. So we're actually recording this just as 2020 comes to an end, but we're going to put it out at the start of the year. And I think it's, yeah, I want to dive back in. I want to dive back into the topic of anti-racism work. You are the queen of anti-racism work. But I also do just want to hear how you, Nova Reed, found this past year, because what a journey you have been on. I mean, how, like, let's look back a year ago at the start of 2020. What was...
Feels like a different lifetime. It really does.
Yeah. What was going on for you at the start of 2020?
I mean, the start of 2020 was quite gentle because I was doing recovery from surgery.
I was trying to remember when that was.
December, a year ago today.
Wow. Okay. So that's when we did our microaggressions.
So we recorded microaggressions in January because you came to see me.
I did.
Lid, yes.
I did. Yeah. Okay. So it was a year ago we did the microaggressions episode. So you were in recovery. What else was going on?
I just received some feedback on my book proposal, actually, from who are now my publishers. And they'd given some really exquisite feedback that really opened up my writing. Because what I hadn't realized that I'd been doing when I first started writing a book in 2018 was that I was assimilating in my writing. I was code switching. And they gave me some feedback that just opened up my writing. And so I'd not long submitted my new version of the book to them and was waiting to find out how that was being received. And I was thinking about health, really, and how to take better care of myself while I do this work. I was about to go on a spiritual healing retreat. So it's very much about my healing and me helping myself be even more rooted so I can be as impactful and effective whilst keeping myself well at the same time. So it was a really introspective and gentle start to the year, full of lots of what ifs and what might be.
What can you remember what you were hoping 2020 was going to be about? Did you have any?
It was really about the book. I had my vision board and I was like, oh, you're going to get a book deal this year. And I put that on there and there was all this, you know, it's in my bedroom, which me and my husband look at every day. And so there were those sorts of things. Travel was on there as well, but it was mainly the book. There was something that I had put on this vision board that said, now is your time, or something like that. And I was like, wow, okay, that's an understatement.
Now reflecting back, I mean, I don't think perhaps you realised quite what you were saying.
No.
You said, now is your time. Actually, this is an interesting one. Do you remember how many followers you had on Instagram at that time?
So I don't remember. I think in
could
January,
you swipe up? Could you swipe up?
I couldn't swipe. So I knew I couldn't swipe up. So
there we go.
It was under 10K. And also in January, my TED Talk was published for the first time.
Was that January? My God,
that
it
was
does
January
feel like a different lifetime. Yeah.
This year. So, of course, that also brought me a new audience or new following, but I was still under 10K, or I had not long just gone over that 10K threshold. I definitely couldn't swipe up in January. And then I remember sort of towards May talking with my supervisor and just being really frustrated. So I have something called clinical supervision, I guess, the type of therapy, but more around business. Well, it's kind of both. But I was talking to them and I was really frustrated about how many followers I had and how little of them were engaging with my professional services that can help them. And I remember just being really frustrated about that and saying, I mean, like 0.005% or whatever it is of you are actually doing this work. Like, change isn't going to happen until you do it. Like, it's all well and good me creating this content, but you have to do the work. And then obviously the summer of 2020 is one that will go down in the history books, where we had this sequence of events of you know, deaths on black bodies being so publicly broadcast. And I just watched my following, which around that time was about 11,000, which, you know, from January to May, it's not a huge increment. Mm. It increased to 40,000 in less than 2 days.
In less than 2 days. I remember watching.
Yeah.
I remember watching the numbers going up because I think at one point you had taken you stepped away from social media because it was just all too much. And I remember being like, oh my, by day, it was like going up by the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
And how, well, first of all, what was that time like for you? Because obviously you and I were in touch and I just the pain and the anguish just went so deep into like
it was I still can't actually find the words to fully articulate it, and perhaps in a year's time I'll be able to be more eloquent around articulating how it feels to have so many adults only just waking up to the fact that racism is an issue. That's very confronting. That's very sobering. That's very painful. And effectively, that includes my friendship circle as well. So many saying I didn't realise. And I'm thinking, well, have you not been listening to me? Where have you been? Like, have you been asleep? Like, how is it that you have got through most of your adult life and not realised or not cared enough? That's the element. So that was very confronting on a personal level. And in terms of business, I kind of got what I asked for. I was so frustrated about how few people were engaged. And then suddenly there was this tsunami. It was just me doing this. I had no infrastructure to cope with the demand overnight. And so there were lots of things behind the scenes that needed to be happen. And I had a number of anti-racism students volunteer their skills to help deal with that volume. But also on top of that, I'm also writing a book. I'm also still teaching anti-racism. And I'm also Nova, the human being who was also a Black woman and isn't immune from what it's like to see racism and basically a modern day lynching being broadcast around the internet, like we're putting bread in a toaster. And I lost 12 inches of hair. My hair fell out. So that's the answer. And it's complex because in the middle of that, I also felt rooted. I was like, okay, now I know why I've been put on this earth.
You had done this healing work, this spiritual retreat, The Bridge, which many of our listeners know about because I mention it as many times as I can on a podcast. Did that, doing that healing work, help you to navigate through such a tumultuous, painful, huge grieving? I know you and Donna from The Bridge, actually, you did that Instagram live of a grieving
ritual, really.
Yeah, a grieving ritual, but predominantly for the Black community. Everyone was invited, but it was a huge time of grieving, wasn't it?
Collective grief. Felt it physically in my body. And so I knew that what I was carrying was not just mine. And I, to people who don't understand about or maybe are skeptical about ancestry or spirituality, there is collective pain that you feel when you've come from a community that has experienced mass genocide and oppression. It's collective, it's visceral. None of us knew George, but yet my hair was falling out. And I'm having conversations with other people who are Black about, you know, not sleeping or going into a state of depression, not even do you see what I mean? So it was profound. I've always been involved in healing, mental health, you know, counselling. They're the bedrock of, you know, me staying well, me being able to do my work and my job. It was the foundation of my training in order for me to work in mental health. So I've always had that. Therapy has always been in my life, either personally or professionally. So I already had the tools and, you know, things in place. But what I think going on the bridge did was open me up even more. And so, yeah, it absolutely helped me to be able to hold more, I guess, than perhaps what I would have before. And also to allow me to do some of my own healing around the pain that I've experienced, you know, in terms of racism in a much more in-depth way than traditional psychotherapy ever could, because, you know, there, sadly, white supremacy seeps into everywhere, including the therapy room, and there are so many Black people and brown people who can't get the support that they need. In fact, let me stick it with Black people. There are people who are Black who cannot get the psychotherapy or the counselling support that they need because their therapists are not anti-racist or experienced in dealing with Black trauma. And you end up being gaslit in the therapy room, you end up having to code switch, or you end up self-abandoning and not really speaking about everything that's going on because you're worrying about hurting their feelings because they're white. Mm. So The Bridge allowed me to not have to worry about any of that, which I think just made me be able to have more capacity to hold this collective trauma, shock and everything else and start to support and lead people through it.
I don't think that people realise how painful and traumatic doing your work is and what you have to hold in terms of you have to be in the space of daily racism and often racist attack on you personally by turning up and doing this work. Like, you get it from what I know from over the past like 6 months or so, you've been really putting in boundaries to protect your space. But at that time, at the time of George Floyd, when you'd had 11,000 followers and suddenly you had 40,000 and all the world was looking on you and the other anti-racist educators. And what did, as much as, so there's lots of white people going, what can I do? What can I do? And we'll talk about this later, why that is no longer a question that it's appropriate anymore, because there's so much out there. But at the time, a lot of people rushing saying, oh, I didn't realize, you know, what can I do? So there's the pain of that, of being like reaffirming that you've not been listening. But then, of course, you've got, an onslaught of people coming to attack. And were you getting those messages on the comments, in DMs, emails? Like, what was happening for you?
It was everywhere. It was comments. So I've since gone on some great training by a company called Glitch, Fix the Glitch. And they do online safety training, and they do a lot of work with companies like Twitter and Instagram about making their online spaces safer, particularly, not exclusively for, but people who are in marginalized identity receive more abuse online. Yeah. And then when you start dissecting that, women receive more hate than men online. And then when you dissect that further, Black women in Twitter in particular, we receive 84% of online hate. 84%.
So, of all online hate?
Of Twitter, on Twitter. Yeah, 84% Black women. So that to me is quite revealing. So the company offers support for activists in how to keep themselves safe online. So I did something with them in June, I think, that made a huge difference to, it's less... It's not as easy to access me as it used to be. Mm-hmm. But it was, it was in the comments, it was DMs, emails. And then when they get no response there, they then go into my emails. But what happened is I have people who are doing the work on my anti-racism course, and like, I am here, let me know what you need. This is what I'm good at. Let me know if I can help in some way. And so now I have a team of anti-racism students who go through, I mean, it's less required now because I've changed some of my settings, but they go through my comments and they will just delete stuff that's racist before I even see it.
Yeah.
So there's a barrier, there's a protective barrier there. Unless I say, have we received anything inflammatory? Let me know what it is. Give me the highlights, because sometimes I'll use them as examples to help people understand what racism looks like and, as a learning opportunity. But that helped enormously. But it was this very strange sense of entitlement over me, like, you must give me what I need now.
Yes, I remember you saying, because you had this... hundreds of people suddenly signing up to do the course. So like you said, it was only you, and you needed to take some time out because you were just so exhausted.
You know what? I didn't take time out because I had a live training program for white people to that was running.
That was it.
I had to suck up and do that. So I was holding space for what was 70... mostly white women to excavate their racism in the middle of all that. So I just had to put an out of office on and say, look, you're going to have to wait. It's as simple as that.
And I remember you saying to me, you were like, you know what? I've hardly had anyone signing up to my course. Now everyone wants to sign up to it and they want it now, Nova. Like, I can no longer be in this hideous discomfort and this shame spiral. You need to help me out now,
It's just that also is the racism as well. You must give me what I want now. Exploitive, extraction. No regard for what is going on. If you want to be anti-racist, you'll be well aware of what is going on in the world and that I'm a Black woman. But there was not all, but sadly majority, it was like there was a separation, that I was just a service provider and not a human being underneath that.
Yeah. And going through what you were clearly going to be going through.
And also still teaching.
And still holding 70 white women going through excavating their own anti-racism. What have since then, you know, we had the whole world suddenly focused on Black Lives Matter. A lot of people, white people for the first time saying, I'm going to do better. I'm going to do the work. Some of that was performative. Some of that was like, I did think at the time, I was just like, this is amazing that, you know, Leila Saad's book is like sold out. How many of those books are going to end up collecting dust and, you know, not be opened by the end of the year? What have you observed? Do you think that it has created a new momentum? Are you seeing a lot more people engaged in the work? Do you feel like a lot of it was performative? Like, on that scale, what have you seen happen since then?
Well, I've seen all of it. And I think actually Leila did a post on her Instagram a similar time that I was commenting on my observations, where I think she shared about it in an article she was interviewed for, where there was around 55 people who signed up as part of a book club or a reading circle to do Me and White Supremacy. And weeks later, there were only 5 people left in that group. I had people sign up for my course at the beginning of June, so the height of, you know, George Floyd's death becoming mainstream, and they are still yet to even log on.
Mm.
So that to me is the essence. I would much rather people didn't engage unless they're wanting to do it, or donated that money to people who can't afford to do my course but really want to do the work, rather than just have it sitting there collecting dust. That to me is the essence of performative allyship. So yeah, it's definitely been a mixed bag, and apathy is there, because I also think what happened in that period is you get people who are understanding it in its essence of what being actively anti-racist is. And then you've got people who think that they know what it is because they want to be seen to be a good, one of the good white people who isn't racist. But when they realise what being actively anti-racist commands of them, they start shrinking back into into the wings and recoiling. But, you know, the only difference is now, like, now you know, and you're consciously choosing to continue to uphold white supremacy. And if that's your choice, then own it and lean into it. But don't claim that you're an ally or that you're anti-racist, because that's not it. And it's not to say that it's, you know, it's not, I know myself, it's not easy work. It's ongoing.
Oh my God, no.
You have to pace yourself.
It's the hardest work there is. I mean, it's like, but what was anyone expecting?
Yeah.
It ain't comfortable. Jesus, that is the hardest work I've ever done, hands down. And it is some of the most important work I've ever done. Mm. Probably the most important work I've ever done to date.
So either you want to do it or you don't. And whatever that decision is, then make it with honesty and integrity.
There definitely is not a fun, easy way to do it.
No, and I think that's the challenge, because there will be it will be presented in the way that it is. Just, oh, you can just say these 2 phrases, or, you know, just do these 2 things, just write to your MP and that's it, job done. Actually, those are the really easy things that we should all be doing as a bare minimum. The work really starts when you start interrogating your own racism, because that's a question I get asked all along. And I know you said we talk about it later, but you're telling it now. Like, what can I do? What can I do? My answer is always unlearn your racism. Like, that's the starting point. That's where you should be beginning your journey, because what you do is very much dependent on how much you've got to unlearn and then relearn, who you are, what your role is in all of this. And also, you know, being transparent about why you don't know what to do.
Mm.
Why don't you know?
Yeah, well, but and also particularly now. Like, I mean, Renée Ando-Lodge has been saying this for years. She hates that. She hates that question. She hates that question. And, you know, at the start of 2020, you could be forgiven for asking that question. But I can't remember what event where someone said that recently, you know, well, what can we do as white people? What can we do? And you and I were like commenting about it, being like, that is no longer, and you cannot be asking that question anymore. Have you been under a rock for the whole of 2020?
Just Google it.
There is so much stuff out there that helps white people to address their inner racism, which we all have.
And I think that, you know, not to be flippant with it, it is overwhelming. I understand that. But what was done in summer this year was so much free labour. So many people recognised the experience of overwhelm and collated podcasts, films, book, activists, people to follow and put them in one resource. So there really is no excuse now because that labour's been done. But I compare it to other communities that I, you know, want to show up for in you know, being a support for and a better human. So I don't know. There are going to be things I miss about living with a physical disability. Mm. So I don't burden the people in my life who have physical disabilities and ask them what I can do. I go and do my own research and reading. I do the same with people who are trans. Like, it's not their job to educate me. If they choose to, or I'm going to an educator, that's different. So it's about taking on self-agency. And in anti-racism, that seems to be a huge missing ingredient for some people. It's like they lose the resources to be able to think for themselves in that initial step anyway. Then when you realize you want to go in and do more work and have support and be led by an educator, then again, you know how to find those educators online and then, you know, pay for their expertise when you can. There's lots of free resources.
Yeah. For me, it is, I see it in the context of huge collective healing.
Yes.
Work that we need to do. And healing is never that much fun. it's never fun or easy. It can be deeply, deeply uncomfortable and painful when you're leaning in and facing your shadow and the stuff you don't want to look at. And whatever stage you're doing it. And this is the same and some more, like, because you're also going back through generations. Like, it's so embedded, it's so deep-rooted. When you were taught, I recommend to everyone the episode that you did. Well, I recommend your entire Conversations with Nova, listen to the whole flipping lot. But you did an interview on Leila Saad's podcast. It was such a beautiful episode. You two have such love for each other. And it was wonderful to hear two anti-racism educators talking together about that work and doing that work. So it was just, it was so powerful. You talked a lot, though. I don't know if you remember this. Because I remember saying to you after, it's like, wow, you said some seriously powerful stuff about healing,
yes,
particularly for the Black community,
yes,
healing these wounds and the work there that is to be done. And I remember getting goosebumps, being like, oh, that is no, like, as well as educating white people on how to become actively anti-racist, that healing, like,
for me, this, I don't do this, the reason I do this work is for us as in people, Black people, people of colour who experience racism, to be liberated.
Yeah.
And so I always frame my work that it is around collective healing. It is around stopping causing pain to people who have to live with this stuff because it's too confronting for other people to address. And it is collective healing. It's healing for you as well, because racism was built on so many lies. We're so invested in protecting our innocence or our perceived innocence. Oh, I'm one of the good ones. Oh, I didn't mean that. And da, 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 da. Just be honest and surrender that, yes, it is unavoidable. I have inherent racism and I'm doing something about it. It's so freeing when you just are truthful about where you are on that journey. And you don't have to do this tap dance to convince people that you're not racist, because we've already experienced your racism. And like, who are you convincing? We already live with it. So, yeah, that's always been the way that I have approached anti-racism, and will always. It's about collective healing.
Do you feel like it has got better do you feel like the lived day-to-day experience of Black people, I know you can't speak for Black people.
No.
But I know from like you've put on a post on Instagram not so long ago, how have white people in your life, two Black and brown people, have white people in your life who are doing anti-racism work, how has that, have you felt a difference? Have you felt a shift? Like,
I mean, let me speak from the people who are sharing their stories with me. So the common response I got was, when those are doing the work, it has changed. It has transformed our relationship. I feel like a full human being. Can you imagine that? I feel like a full human being. I feel heard. So transformed in a very short space of time because they're taking responsibility and they are aware and being more mindful. But the common denominator with all of that was that, but it's just a handful. It's one. There is nowhere near enough people who are white or who are white privileged who are doing this work and are continuing to cause harm because they don't think they're racist because they got Black friends, partners, mixed race Black kids, or whatever other excuses used to weaponize our Blackness to make them feel like they are exempt. But that was for the feedback where people were doing the work, it was transformative, very healing. I feel like a full human being came up over and over again. I don't need to anglicize my or change myself. So this sense of belonging and being seen, that's powerfully healing. And my point is that, you know, that's a relatively short period of time and nobody's, you know, fixed. We're imperfect, but they've started that journey and it has already transformed relationships. Same with people who are in interracial relationships as well, similar feedback. From a personal perspective, it's just been very sobering that in my life, very few white friends are doing anti-racism work. And I have to hold boundaries up about what I will no longer tolerate. And that's meant the end of some relationships that were, you know, very meaningful. And I'm still going through a grieving process around that. It's actually really painful. So I acknowledge that for anyone who is, you know, feeling the estrangement of that. But you've also got to hold boundaries around what you will and will no longer tolerate. If there's been opportunities to, you know, if you've had conversations and there's been no change in behaviour over a period of time, then some decisions need to be made. Because we're taught as Black people, as people of colour, to be grateful, to be thankful, to fit in, to assimilate, all these things that mean our experience of the world is compromised. And we're all used to making these compromises over and over again. And I think what this period has also highlighted is that a lot of people are realizing that that's bullshit and that we deserve to be treated like full human beings. And actually some of these things are not okay anymore. Mm. And they will speak up about it. So that's the other thing. It's also empowering people who are Black and brown or other people of colour to start speaking up more about what it's like to live with racism and how that impacts them in their worlds. And that's also been quite healing because we're often silenced. So yeah, it's giving more people a voice to be courageous about being honest.
I think there's a really interesting kind of journey that goes on. When I first started really becoming aware of my inner racist programming was after I did the Bridge Retreat, and I really worked on my anger and rage of feeling oppressed as a woman. And once I got through that healing journey, something came out, it's like, hold on
what's
a second.
Yeah.
On the flip side of that coin, there's actually you as the oppressor. And in the same way as I think for some people, suddenly engaging in self-interrogation, white people, and saying, right, you know, where am I being racist, and looking at racism and looking at, you know, what's the lived experience of Black and brown people in the world today, I think then it could naturally trigger some people who also experience discrimination in other ways to go, hold on a second, if we're saying that's not okay, then what I experience isn't okay either. And I'm like, yeah.
It's correct.
Exactly. Yeah.
No one's saying so
let's,
it's not.
Yeah, so let's look at that and let's deal with that. And of course, then that's more pain coming to the surface and not everyone wants to deal with that either of the pain of being oppressed and being discriminated against. So that's why it is, you know, the healing process is a real messy, uncomfortable old game.
Because what it requires is accountability.
Ooh.
It requires us to be accountable for our part. So yes, we can be, you know, we're not one-dimensional, we're complex. And we can, particularly those who fall in other minority identities, we can experience situations, depending on where we are or who we are with, where we hold more societal privilege and also contribute to the discrimination of others without unknowingly, and also where we experience discrimination or oppression. Like both of those things are true at once, and acknowledging, you know, the spotlight being shone on anti-racism shouldn't take away from your own individual experience of experience discrimination or, you know, marginalization in some way. It doesn't take it away, but the very function of white supremacy is to make us feel like we're competing with one another.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
And then nothing gets resolved because
exactly. They were bickering.
We start half talking about something else, and then again, you know, what about? And then nothing gets resolved, and we just go round and round in circles.
Well, yeah, because you get stuck into the intellectual debate.
Well, I don't.
People can get stuck in the intellectual debate and not then want to actually avoid doing the work.
Yeah.
You know, we might not, it's not necessary that we're deliberately doing that, but that's for sure what we get just caught up on. So Nova, going into 2021, carrying on with this work, obviously I think everyone should do your course because I found it so profound, life-changing, powerful. Your work has such power to it, and you feel the love underneath as well. Like, you get that accountability all the flipping time. And it's extremely uncomfortable. What would you like 2021 to be like for you? How would you like it to feel? What do you want to experience more of?
I want everyone to start experiencing more joy, because we can just see in the world, in the political climate, you know, we've been under extraordinary difficult circumstances with this pandemic that is exposing pre-existing inequity, and it is breeding more fear of the other. And I think if more people were able to live from a place of joy, and that means they have access to basic human rights, then how we show up and operate and function in the world will be very, very different. So my wish for me and everyone is that we're able to start experiencing more joy. And as a result of that, you know, people are able to access or have access to basic human rights and being treated as full human beings. Like, we have a lot of work to do in terms of humanity. We've seen with the pandemic that we're all connected. We're all connected.
Yeah.
Literally. And if we are all, you know, the majority of us are able to be happy, healthy, or have access to resources that can support us with what we need to enable us to be happy and healthy, then it just has a knock-on effect on everything. And I feel that trauma and that grief at the moment. You know, we're not a healthy or happy nation, and that's showing out in disparities. It's showing up in behaviour. It's showing up in who is leading the country and what's been role modelled. So joy, and we can all experience pockets of joy. I wouldn't be able to do anti-racism work without it. So it not only boosts resilience, I think it's an act of resistance as well. So practicing more joy. And I think, like, learning to be more honest. Such a powerful comment from a colleague called Daniel Edmund, on his Instagram very recently, and he moved to the UK about 10 years ago. And he talked about his experience of racism in the UK versus the US, because we often like to compare and say we're the least racist country. And it was something about, it's like the racism in Britain is so insidious because it's under this veneer of niceness and kindness. What we're doing underneath all that is not being honest. We can be honest about things without being cruel to one another. But pretending that, you know, speaking the truth and asking for each other to be better is not being kind. It's part of that that makes you a little bit less human. So it's learning to be honest with love, and functioning from a place of honesty rather than dishonesty or denial. And that's across the board. That's with friendships. That's one of the things that's come up a lot. There's so many people who are struggling with friendships at the moment. And I think fundamentally it's because there's been a foundation where you've not been able to be yourself. And there's an element where you've not been able to be honest about how things affect you. So more honesty with love, and more joy and
more holidays.
More holidays. Anything has got to be better than 2020. I mean, come on. The bare minimum, just for me, like, I'm a really tactile person. I just want to hug people again.
Oh, me too, Nova.
I am really missing that basic human need for physical touch. And I love my husband's hugs, and I'm grateful that I'm in lockdown with another human being, whereas some people are isolated. But that basic fundamental connection that we get from human touch is missing. And I wonder if that is also contributing to how people are functioning right now.
Nova, thank you so much. Oh, you've really moved me with that final bit. You are always such a joy. You always come with such powerful words and such deep wisdom when you come onto this podcast. And actually, anytime you open your mouth, I tend to find that. Thank you a million times over for the work that you do. It takes such extraordinary strength and courage and commitment. And I wish for your 2021 to be filled with so much joy, so many hugs, and of course, your book coming out.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, The Good Ally, my debut book about anti-racism, of course, will be out on the 2nd of September 2021. And it also coincides with a big birthday. So I'm really hoping we'll be in a position where we can be in physical contact, because we need more connection now as human beings more than ever to move through this period. And I can't wait to see you and other incredible humans who are engaged in this work in real life.
And have
the work.
Lots of hugs. And where can people, best place for people to go is novareed.com, isn't it?
Novareed.com, or if you want to pre-order the book, you can do that via your favourite bookstore. But yeah, novareed.com will point you in the direction of my TED Talk podcasts and any other free resources you want to dip your toes in.
So people can already pre-order the book?
They can.
Amazing. I will include that specific link in the show notes so everyone can go pre-order. I can't wait.
There's honesty and there's joy and there is real tools to make huge change. So yeah, I can't wait for you to have it.
I can't wait either. Thank you, Nova.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Project Love podcast. We really hope you enjoy this episode. And if you did, then come and subscribe on iTunes and we'll deliver each new episode straight to your device. And we would love it if you would leave us a review to help us spread the love far and wide. And if you can't think of anything to write, then just tap 5 stars and say, best podcast ever. Thank you.